Hello and welcome to another episode of Talk About Tomorrow, the Futurist podcast with me, Tom Cheesewright. And it's another bonus episode with an interview because today I'm talking to a fascinating futurist and a man I would characterise as busy, Trond Undheim. Welcome to the podcast, Trond.
Thanks so much. And I love the characterisation. It's one of the most wonderful things people have ever said about me.
So, I mean, I really like to start these conversations by understanding a bit about how you got to where you are. And with you, like with so many of the guests on this podcast, it's a fascinating story because you've done and continue to do a lot of stuff. And, you know, in the corporate realm, in the startup realm, in the academic realm, just give us a sort of potted history of your career and how you got to what you're doing today.
Yeah, sure, I'll do that. But let me just preface it with saying the reason I do so many things is that I'm not really particularly great at anything. and this is... I want to be upfront about that because it's an important context. So I figured out pretty early that I was a jack of all trades. And so I have perfected that. So that's the why. And now if you want to know the how, basically... the other thing, I have a very negative characteristic is I'm extremely impatient. So you combine the two of those, you know, there's limited options on the market. But anyway, you know, I mean, the thing is, I was in the educational system for some reason. I really hate schooling. I always hated, the compulsory school. I hate to sit in a classroom. When I got to university, I thought it would be a little better, but I started really hating university as well. It's just, I don't like structured learning. So I try to get out of there as fast as I could. You know, I kind of zoomed through university, just got out of there. But then, you know, I discovered that work life is frustrating too. So I wanted to do so many things. And I guess the only thing is, what has saved me is this. I have tried to apply for stuff and I never get anything. I mean, I apply for like probably 700 jobs and I never get any of those. But then I've been lucky enough to be tapped on the shoulder more than once for all kinds of work opportunities. I mean, one of the times it put me into kind of this think tank working on technology policy for government. This was in Norway where I'm from. And then the next time someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, well, you should work at the EU on, e-government policy. And I said, okay, I guess that's what I should do. So I did that. And then Oracle tapped me and said, hey, you know, you should get out of the EU now and you should work for us on tech and standardization. I'd never really thought I would work on standardization. I said, okay, I'll do that. And, it's continued that way. The only thing is I got to the US some years ago and then I actually didn't have a job. So I started knocking on office doors. And predictably, after having knocked on about 300 doors, the first door I had knocked on opened and said, yeah, why don't you come and work a little bit at MIT? So, I mean, this is how I explain. And then the next job I got also was, you know, someone said, we need somebody to build out the startup ecosystem at MIT. And I said, that's crazy. You already have a startup ecosystem. Well, you know, maybe, maybe not. So Tom, that's how I explain my life. It's a series of knocks on the door and taps on the shoulder. And I can't explain it any other way.
It's really interesting because I found myself almost accidentally doing some mentoring the last few years, and you're particularly in conversations with people who are in their mid-20s and they're so worried about this sort of lack of structure in their careers. They feel like they've got no direction and they're not, you know, achieving enough. And I'm looking at them going, I still don't really know what I want to do, but I had absolutely no idea what I was doing at that point. And there's, you know, so much of it is sort of chance and just being busy and sort of running at stuff until something happens. I mean, do you think there's a connection between that busyness and the people you come across?
There's a big connection. And in fact, you know, I'm going to give a plug now to Christian Bush, who I just got to know, who's a wonderful author of this new book called The Serendipity Mindset. And, you know, I'm reading it right now and he's coming on my podcast soon. But the thing is, serendipity is the name of the game. But how, and what he writes about is so true, and I've been concerned about this for a long time, is you have to be ready for serendipity. It's not like things just happen to you. It's because you are prepared, you work hard, and then you have to be open to the fact that something slightly different happens than what you had planned. Because, you know, the way I served it up to you, it sort of sounds like people, you know, I'm just in the man and people keep knocking on the door. I have so many failures all along the way. In fact, I had to write a book about my last 15 failures so that I would survive, you know, like mentally. But the point is, you know, it's not that I don't have any skills and that I don't work on things. I work really hard at things. But then I think I have an uncanny ability to kind of just, I don't know, rise out of failure or just see things out of nothing, you know, and kind of, I guess, be available and you know, show the signal to somebody that, you know, I might be available to do something exciting. Or, you know, it could be people you meet. Serendipity is very, very planned.
And based on this book and your experience, do you think this is a mindset and a skill set that can be taught? Do you think people can develop that sort of serendipity-seeking mindset?
So I really want to think so, because I'm an optimistic person, but I've also met people who cannot be taught that. So, I mean, I think it's a mixed bag.
But I think I do think it's really important that people, it feels like we're in this transition phase at the moment where, you know, our parents maybe had this understanding of a life track that is very different to the typical life track of someone in their early 20s today. Whereas, you know, you could expect to own a house, you could expect to be settled down with a partner and maybe a kid in your mid-20s, you could expect to work for the same organization or at least in the same career for 30, 40 years. Whereas those expectations have all gone away inside the space of a generation. I do feel like people are caught by this, the speed at which those expectations have shifted.
I agree with you. I'm lucky, I think, because my father actually told me early on. He said, look, times are going to change. I don't know if he was much of a futurist himself, but he read a lot of stuff and he was an academic. And I think his perspective was just, he saw that the world that I was moving into was not going to be anything like his. And he even said, look, there's no guarantee that progress and wealth and, you know, will continue the way that Western society has gone. You are pretty much on your own. You're going to have to prepare to have, you know, 15, 20 jobs in your lifetime. So I knew, based on trusting that advice, that you're going to have to be self-made. You can't just walk into some profession. All of that doesn't mean that you don't want to prepare for it. So, I mean, the way I prepared for it was, I wanted to learn a lot of different things, and I've always been a bit of a, I guess they call it, psychologists call it a project identity. Both my parents are psychologists, so pardon if I speak in psycho-speak. So, you know, a project identity, right, that you always have these projects, and you're not so worried about your current state. You're not really so worried about where you're going. You just want to go in a direction that makes sense to you, and you're always working on something. And it's always different things. They may or may not kind of pan out the way you thought, or they may or may not kind of go in the same direction. But project identity people want to change things. And, you know, we have all these things in mind that we want to see, you know, come into the world. But if we achieve it, we're never happy because now we have moved on to some other project, right? So there's no end state to this. It's just we are all in this endless process.
So it's really interesting that you're sort of, I mean, it does sound like your father sounds like an amazing man. Like he was really a futurist and he was thinking that far ahead. And you're now speaking to lots of people with that sort of futurist mindset for your podcast. Like, how has that changed your thinking at all as you've been interviewing people and speaking to people? Is it a different approaches to the future, different aspects of the future?
You mean, has speaking to a lot of people changed my own view? Definitely.
Yeah, particularly recently since you've been doing this podcast, Futurized, like your
very
perspective
much
on the future.
Yeah, I mean, Futurized has, first of all, it's humbling because I realize, number one, I'm a very dumb individual. I should have had a podcast in the 90s, you know, I mean, because this is what I like to do. I like to talk to smart people. I sometimes like to listen, but I like to interject. I like to kind of voice my opinion. It's great. So, and you know, seriously, I've learned so much. And in fact, I think that I'm thinking about all of the academic research that goes into kind of interviews where you listen to them on tape maybe once and then it goes away. And then all of the interviews that people do that never gets recorded or listened to at all. And I think about all that waste, because every conversation I have, and literally definitely every 10th conversation I have, leads to something extremely tangible.
Okay.
It could be some collaboration. It could be some serious new thought that results in an article or a book. They rarely goes by where I don't learn something so fundamental that I not only have to write it down, but I will discuss it with, you know, the next person I meet or share it with my kids. It is amazing when you do a little bit of pre-planning in your conversation and you actually care about the other person and you start from the departure point, I'm going to learn something and I'm going to try to drag something out of this person that they didn't know that they knew. And that's always my starting point when I talk to somebody on the podcast. You know, I don't want to just talk about what they always talk about. I want to go a layer deeper. And that just forces a kind of conversation that sometimes is actually life-changing.
Interesting. You're telling me I should be more robust in my questioning now.
No, I'm telling you, you're doing the right thing. I don't know about this conversation, but I've listened to some of the other ones and you're doing all the right things.
So, I mean, one of the things that really, you know, engaged me with that, with your podcast and the variety of people you're speaking to is these different perspectives on the future. And it feels to me, and it's something I pinged over to you before we had this conversation, it feels like so much of the conversation at the moment is futurism as survival. Now, even the conversation we've just been having about careers is a great example of that, where we're talking to people about how to survive this disrupted environment, the many careers, the constant learning. And, you know, when I'm having conversations behind closed doors with clients as well, they're not asking me about, you know, wonderful utopian science fiction visions of a potential future. They're asking me about, you know, what are the five things that are going to take our business out at the knees in the next 5 years? And it kind of feels like, I don't know, I've seen a few people questioning and challenging futurists particularly on this recently, saying, shouldn't your job be about more than that? Shouldn't it be about more than survival? Shouldn't it be about, you know, what's next? And I guess I wanted to get your take on this, because I'm feeling like I ought to be lifting my eyes to the further horizon a little more often and being a bit more speculative and a bit less defensive, I guess.
All right, so let me say this, because, you know, your audience is not yet my client, so I can say this. I mean, never listen too much to your clients, in the sense that, you know, there's something fundamental there. If you listen too much to your market, or at least to the people who pay you, you're not being creative and you're not being innovative and you're not really seeing around the corner. So I think market research and the recent elections have taken this to an extreme. You can't listen to the market when you're in the business of creating the future. You know what I'm saying? Because per definition, the market doesn't know the future. If they did, they wouldn't be asking you. You wouldn't exist. So we are an alternate reality here. We're trying to create a space for possibility, creating something beyond. And I really believe that there is a role to carve out for people like us, I guess, who really try to pull together almost an impossible number of variables. But the other thing that I really wanted to talk to you about is, for me, being a futurist is not speculative and it's not crazy. You know, we are just looking at factors we know will change, and we're just kind of running the dial on those factors. And the difficulty isn't to know which factors are salient. So certain types of technologies are going to count, certain types of social phenomenons, you know, are going to happen. Human nature is what it is. Like, you add those things together, it's not complicated. It's just that it's hard work to keep all those things in mind at the same time. And then, you know, our privilege is to be a little bit less bogged down in day to day. So this is, you know, I think incessantly why prophets get beheaded and stuff, because it's not popular necessarily, right? The stuff you start saying, it's either like dystopian and people hate you for that, or it's like this optimistic future that they're like, yeah, that's ridiculous. You know, off you go. I mean, you'll never be really popular if you're a very good futurist. A mediocre futurist will get very popular.
I'm now starting to wonder about measure my own popularity. Perhaps I should be targeting absolute unpopularity. It's a really interesting point, because there is that sort of constant tension between, and a British author was tweeting about this earlier, and she's kind of in that futurism domain, where you are in that sort of tension between what is, commercially what people are chasing, and the sort of the flights of fancy that you want to go off on. And I mean, like, I agree with you, they're not sort of speculative. We really are exploring this sort of, the opportunities in the future, and recognizing possibilities based on, as you say, an understanding of human nature, an understanding of what's possible and where that sort of human nature takes you inside what's possible. But it does feel like there's that sort of constant tension there. I guess maybe I need to go off and write some science fiction and go and explore the possibilities that way. Because like you, I mean, I don't describe myself necessarily as getting frustrated very quickly, but I've always described myself as a butterfly. The reason I love this job is I can settle in an industry, delve into it for 6 weeks, and go off and do something completely different.
Yeah, and that there's a blessing there. I mean, I think not a lot of people have that luxury. But, my latest book that's coming out in March on future tech really has as its goal to get more people involved in that kind of thinking. I don't think everybody needs to spend 100% of their time being a futurist, but I do think that if not more of us take deeply seriously, the idea that there is a future out there, and if you don't plan for it and think about it, you are bound to repeat some stupid mistakes that, all your contemporaries are making, and the legacy of the past, which unfortunately typically goes in particular directions.
So tell me about the book. I'm trying to work this out. Is this your third or fourth?
Or even fifth? This is the fourth book. So Future Tech, it's all about actually anything but tech, right? So the thesis is simply that technology's future holds so much more than technology. And, what shapes technology, even the founders of tech companies, what starts them out isn't just tinkering with technology. They have some goal in mind, they have a challenge they have seen, or the obstacles they face along the way, or should face along the way, from the likes of governments or competitors or customers. They shape the technology so much more than we are usually willing to admit. And I think taking all of those forces into account is really what shapes the future of technology. So I have a framework to try to understand that, and I go through some examples of how this has worked out in the past. But really, the goal isn't to sort of be this super smart futurist, but to say that if you're going to think about the future, if you want to have a certain future, if you want to take a part in the future, you need to understand the way these things work. And maybe you disagree with me about the relative weight of, regulation versus, the innovative mindset. And some of these are politically charged opinions. That's fine. But I think we cannot any longer run around and trust a separate set of experts that know all these things, because those people rapidly don't even exist. I mean, I'm sure you have the same view. You talk to an expert in graphene and they're an expert in graphene and that's it. And then next day you meet someone who's an expert in cancer and they're an expert in cancer. Well, I mean, what are the connections here? But when you're developing real world change, sometimes you need to combine those two. And the only answer here is politicians, because they combine all these things. But the way they combine it and the way we as futurists combine it, there's a massive difference.
It does. Right. It's really, I mean, you're highlighting there the importance of this bridge role. And, I've historically talked about the importance of people who can talk to humans and talk to technology. But actually, there's a different role there, isn't there? Which is this sort of connector role, which I guess in some ways might have been what you were doing in your startup role, where you're actually bringing together the relevant people to solve problems and build this sort of ecosystem. It does feel like we need more of that cross connection, like you say. I mean, the National Graphene Institute with the local research hospital, I'm sure there are loads of opportunities if you bring them together. But actually, There's very few people being funded to do that cross connection unless they are driven by venture capital.
Well, the thing is, for a long time, this was viewed as soft skills, which, were easy. So in my book, I spend a little time on this, but I think that, what I'm hoping for is that we all should aspire to become a little bit of polymaths. And to be a true polymath, you really respect what otherwise becomes looked upon as a soft skill. And by the way, psychology, there's nothing soft about it, or team skills, or, you know, any of the things that people might consider soft, whether it's art, creativity, any of those things, because you need some sort of language to translate between specialty fields. Or in the absence of that language, you have to tweak each specialty language so that you at least can talk across boundaries. And who is going to do all that work, right? And who's going to pay for it? I actually think there will be many, many successful businesses that their sole purpose is to communicate between these sets of expertise, just because as technology becomes more advanced, well, I mean, you and I were talking about it before we started recording. I really desperately need a 2.0 for all of this presentation technology that we're confronted with, you know, whether it is how to fit your headset with video into your laptop so that you can do something as basic as just have a conversation that's recorded in decent quality where you can see the other person and have some sense of almost being in the room with the person, right? These are that's a very basic demand I have right there. And yet it's not really possible. And it fails all the time. Sort of reminds me of when you go and in the olden days when we went to, you know, to have a speech and then the overhead projector wouldn't work, or, you know, like no one could find the right cable, or the lamp was broken, and, you know, and today, like, you know, projector problems and adapters and HDMI cables and stuff. This is pedestrian stuff, but it blocks us from doing our business.
It's interesting. I was having a conversation about 5G earlier, and then, you know, there's so many sort of bells and whistles that people talk about in terms of, you know, low latency and high speed and how fast you'll be able to do all these things. Like, I just want a robust connection. Like, all I want is not to have to think about whether or not I'm online. I just want to think about the application, nothing else.
Think about the telephone, an analog connection. For 100 years, we were just happily communicating because it was super reliable. You pick up the phone, the person on the other end is reliably going to be there until you say goodbye, right? None of that's possible digitally. Like, I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah. But we've traded some richness, perhaps, for a lot of reliability.
Look, I mean, I'm not going to be a Luddite and say that we haven't moved forward since Alexander Graham Bell, but it is a warning, because I think it is these easy technologies that will survive.
So we've talked about your podcast. We've talked about your book. You're also involved in a startup. Tell me about Yegi. Tell me what you're doing there.
Yeah, so Yegi started out with this idea, I guess slightly grand idea, that knowledge was hard to come by. So we initially started with people, putting people together, solving problems for companies on demand across boundaries and borders. So we did plenty of projects for the likes of, you know, banks and, you know, energy companies, sort of like consulting on demand, but with virtual recruitment and selections of teams that would, you know, be all around the world. And then we would execute a very quick and dirty, but fairly high quality consulting project for those clients. But then lately, over the last 4 years, I've been involved in what I was actually more interested in than just putting people together and doing the stuff that you know, kind of is the same as you would do in person. I wanted to create something more transformational. So the challenge was a little bit too difficult, I would say. So we've been really scratching our heads here. But the idea being, how do you really know that the knowledge and insight you are digesting is the best at any given moment? And to the point we were talking about earlier, given that the world is complicated, now, if you're a business owner, or you're in government, or you are a founder trying to start something, you need the best information about a myriad of different things. It could be 10 topics that previously would take you a PhD to understand. Mm. The vision with Yegi has been to create a somewhat digitized interface where you somehow answer all your questions. And the original vision was how to become an expert over the weekend in anything that you can think of.
It's really interesting, because you're addressing, for me, what is one of the most critical problems we face, which is discovery. Like there is so much knowledge out there. There are so many products, services, people who could solve your problem. How on earth do you find and select the right one? And we're seeing really interesting startups, I think, trying to tackle that in e-commerce, where actually, you know, where in many ways the offline discovery experience is still better than the online discovery experience. There is no or very little serendipity online still. And actually doing that in people and knowledge, I think, is a really interesting part of the problem, because as you say, there are also people who could offer you opinions and probably some level of expertise, but how do you find the right ones to tackle those problems?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. And I think the problem gets compounded by the fact that it's not just about the knowledge. And so not only did we get a little bit bogged down, in all honesty, and I still haven't really fully figured out how this interface really should be built. We have a lot of demo platforms and trials and tests, because actually this pandemic put it all into perspective, right? Because it's not really just about the perfect selection match between, you know, insight and problem. There are human things and motivation that comes into play. So we may think that we are human beings that optimize everything, but at the end of the day, we are lazy buggers. So we just want to solve our problem and move on. And there's something really mature about that, right? Because if you were trying to solve a problem, like my water heater, that's what we call it in the US. I don't know what you call it over there, but anyway.
A boiler, yeah.
A boiler was broken last week. And even though I would like to optimize for the best boiler, and I know there are, you know, just-in-time boilers that don't have the actual unit, and, you know, and they're triple the cost, then there are all these considerations. But at this point, you don't have hot water. So you do want to find the best solution, but the best solution is also something that arrives in a timely fashion and that doesn't screw up, you know, the 19 podcasts I was going to record and the proofs that were, you know, arrived today for my book, the endorsements I need to get, you know, dealing with three kids. And, you know, there's so many other concerns. So I would like to change the world and I would like the perfect boiler, but I need it all at the same time. So at some point you need to optimize and just make a decision. So this platform has to cater to all those things. And then of course you want to enjoy yourself in the process. So there has to be an entertaining aspect to these platforms as well. Now, this is a tall order and it's far more than what a Facebook platform would do for you. And then you have the problem of selecting. That's actually the easiest. We boiled the internet down to about 10,000 sources. That's about it. So the internet, you know, has some 1 billion, you know, or, you know, interesting websites. But among those, in our estimation, there's about 10,000 that really count. So you could get away with that. Now you just organize the information on those. Some of them are pay to play, so that makes it slightly more complicated. Mm. And then, of course, you need to tie into the people who wrote all that information. So that becomes another kind of coordination problem. To be honest, we haven't solved it. We're still working on it. But the vision is that there should be a much easier way than... I'm really, really upset with search. I think search really brought us in the completely wrong direction. The internet was never a search problem. It was always a find problem. You know, let's go back to Picasso. Mm. I never search, I find. And that sounds kind of crazy, right? You know, Picasso can find things, but can you find things? Yes, you can. But you need a lot of help. You need scaffolding. So what Yegi is about is to try to build that scaffolding.
It's such a statement of our age, isn't it? That it's only 10,000 sources we're trawling. Yeah, it's only 10,000 that matter.
Yeah.
Like the fact that we can have that sort of conversation, well, yeah, we can deal with 10,000 sources. I mean, it tells you just how mechanized and how augmented and automated, you know, sort of our ability to deal with data is, even if you've not quite solved that problem, you know, that sort of interface and that discovery problem yet.
It may be 50,000, but I mean, 10,000, you'll be fine. I think there's different layers of, I mean, if you're sending something, you know, up to the moon, may need 50. But
sure.
If you have a water boiler problem, I think you actually could deal with. Yeah, right. So I think different problems call for different number of sources, but it's yeah. Never a billion.
No. And yeah, having been through this problem of boiler failing, It's nothing gets done until that problem's solved. The only thing that's possibly more urgent is fixing broadband. I heard a great story from a landlord here in the UK that the water went off in the block of flats they were operating, and they didn't hear anything for about 2 days. And the broadband went down and they were inundated within 2 hours.
Well, because broadband is critical infrastructure, which no government really has fully... They say they have understood it, right? But, I mean, in the US, broadband is not a right. And, you know, there's no broadband everywhere. It's really crazy.
It's a real privilege there as well with the prices.
Yeah. I mean, there'll sooner be broadband in Africa, I think, actually, than there will be in rural United States. But so that's a whole other story.
Yeah. So, okay, so we've talked about a bit about the present. What about the future? Now, you know, I'm trying to ask everybody this question. Like, you know, what is your, you know, what would you change? What's your sort of mission? If you could see the world being completely different in 5, 10, 20 years, you choose the time frame. But what would you change? What would you change about the world?
I have a very specific vision. And by the way, you know this. I mean, I wrote the book Pandemic Aftermath, thinking about the next decade. And it was a little bit of a dystopian vision. But at the end of it, I do think there's a silver lining. And what's the silver lining? In a couple of words, I believe that in the next decade, really, it truly has to happen in the next decade, we need to come up with a new global governance model that leaves enough wiggle room for local kind of freedom and self-expression and individual self-expression that it actually doesn't become sort of totalitarian regime. We have to develop that structure the same way that the League of Nations was developed out of the ruins of the First World War, and then the United Nations came out of the Second World War. We need something different, right? And it's not just because of the pandemic. It's just every coordination problem goes across borders. But the answer is not some sort of totalitarian system. So you got to think about these things. And I want to be part of Futurized. The podcast is partly about that, trying to develop thinking that goes a little bit more towards the macro and lets individuals of all sorts start to reflect on this, not just experts, thinking about what do we want? How do we want the next 30 years, the next 50 years of the planet to look like? And if we don't get a solution to that involves some sort of coordination across countries, which is more than just trade agreements and bilaterals or even just, you know, structures such as the EU, I think we're going to be in deep trouble. But if we do find those solutions, I think there is a better way. I think there's a better governance structure. I think there's a way to create more unity in purpose across the world based on principles of social innovation. I truly believe people want this. So it's just a massive kind of coordination problem to... you have to think up something that's compelling enough. Then you obviously have to convince a couple billion people. But I think it's doable.
It's really interesting. I mean, I've long felt that the governance we have at the moment is wrongly scaled. It's not that it's all too small, but nation states feel like a very bad fit for most of the challenges facing us, where you need international cooperation to tackle things like tax harmonization, to tackle climate crisis, to tackle pandemics. But you actually need an awful lot more local operation. This may be a not necessarily uniquely, but very strongly a UK problem, where we have an incredibly centralized governance structure where so much of the power is held in Westminster in London. And, you know, the regions have been stripped of spending and power over quite a long time, to the point where they really can't react very well to the unique challenge that even in a, you know, the unique challenges that even in a small country like the UK, different regions have.
Look, I think the pandemic is interesting in that way. And I'm sort of starting now to see the pandemic more from a kind of a bird's eye perspective, because what the pandemic just shows to a lot of people, and, you know, there were many of us who saw that already, you know, you're obviously one of them, The current governance structure, the only good thing you can say about the nation state is that it's actually fairly efficient, right? It has survived for 300 years. It was, a consequence of the Westphalia agreements, and it's fine. It has worked, for a while throughout human history, and it does have this concept of democracy tied to it, which, by the way, also is a completely outdated concept. And that's like swearing in church, right? When you say democracy is outdated. But I mean, I truly believe that it's probably a podcast of its own, but I actually think that we need a different system than democracy. So in my future, we do not, it's a post-democratic society.
Wow.
It's a whole other podcast, but in a network society, democracy is a such dwindling part of the solution. And with fake news and all of these kind of rationalist approaches to society are failing miserably. And the answer is, of course, not to cling to strongmen or, other things. We need a much more advanced governance structure. So that's what I'm talking about. A global post-democratic structure, which isn't, by the way, just a structure. It is actually a very flexible kind of framework where local administrations, and by that I mean, if you can't walk or run there, for lunch, that's not local to me. So it's like, what a normal person, if I can, with a mechanic approach that's not an engine, get to the end of whatever territory, that's not local to me. Because that means it's not really affecting me in my day-to-day.
Mm.
And that is a enormously important level of jurisdiction, local. I think it's actually probably easier to fix the local jurisdiction. And if you think about throughout human history, tribal societies, in my past, right, the Vikings, they were severely limited by their own surroundings. But that also made it kind of a balanced and it was at least very rational to figure out the boundaries. Now, the Vikings had a solution to this, right? Lack of resources, let's go plunder the UK or the pre-UK. But leaving that aside, when you're stuck in a geography, that's very real. You have to live within those resource constraints. Now, we are in the lucky situation that we actually have wealth on this planet. So if we spread that wealth, at least, just in time, whenever a region needs some sort of help, we can pull that in, with loan guarantees, and I don't care, nothing comes for free. I'm not, advocating some sort of society without payments, but a commons-based approach for global governance. And I'm not the first to suggest this. I actually have a guy coming on the podcast soon, Michel Bowens, who is he's kind of the world leader in this kind of commons-based thinking. So that's very inspiring to me.
That is, I think, the idea of, well, talking about Vikings, which I've never done on the podcast before, but most importantly, that idea of post-democracy, I think that is such a great thing to leave people with, a great idea to leave people with, and point people to your podcast, because that sounds like a fascinating interview, if you want to hear more about that idea.
Yeah, futurized.co is where you can hear a lot of interviews. And, like I listen to your podcast, I think people need to pick, it's 45-minute podcast. This takes a while. It's designed for two things. Apparently, it takes 45 minutes to put on makeup in the morning. This is what I've understood. So it's designed to do that, if that you're so inclined. Or you can go for a run, which, sometimes takes me 45 minutes. Or a combination of both. Either way, it's a big investment. But, podcasts, I love podcasts because you can do other things. And that's the point. You can, I guess the only thing you can't do is write books. But you can do, if you're a multitasker, I love podcasts.
Brilliant. We will put a link in the show notes. Thanks so much for your time, Trond. Really appreciate you coming on.
It was a great time, Tom. Thank you.